good afternoon, everybody. Hey, I'm Ann Eller right here with you on WCRS, having a good time, and we are going to have a great conversation. You don't want to miss this one, folks. We are talking to Rusty Fleming. He is the director of Drug Wars, Silver or Lead? Is that part of the title, too?
That's
I
it.
Saw that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you have actually put your life on the line to do this movies. How you doing today, Rusty?
I'm doing great, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We need a little background as to how somebody gets to where you were at, embedded with a drug cartel. I mean, you know, that just seems a little far-fetched to me, and you're a free man walking around free here today?
Absolutely.
So how does this happen, Rusty? Tell us some background.
Well, let's suffice it. I'll play it backwards. How we do
okay.
that? I'm actually the best press agent they ever had. Okay, these guys.
And the federal government is letting you walk around.
There you go.
Okay.
These guys run a Fortune 500 company, and like any other Fortune 500 company, they have an image to manage.
These we're talking about the drug lords, the cartel.
Yes.
Yes.
And that image is anything that makes them out to be the kidnapping, killing, ruthless drug dealing guys that they are is good for business. The simple fact of the matter is, I don't roll with their personal identities. They don't care about, you know, showing cartel tactics and things like that. That's not what bothers them.
Right.
The way I got in, now I want to plug this one time. I wrote a book, and it's in my book how I did all this.
Okay.
But anyway.
Can we have the cliff notes?
You're going to have the notes
okay.
right now. And here's the deal. When I first started in 2005, it was May of 2005, I went down to Laredo, Texas. I had an idea that I was going to do a mini-doc about methamphetamines in Texas. So I followed. The DEA busted a load of about $12 million worth of meth in Dallas, and we traced it to Nuevo Laredo. So I go down there, fat, dumb, and happy, and like I had good sense, and I took a film crew with me, and I took this young man whom I had known all his life, and I knew he was from Laredo. I wanted him because I used him as a fixer, you know, somebody that knew
a
the
fixer.
Town.
Now, wait a minute, what's a fixer?
Okay,
that's
somebody that knows the town, knows the language, knows his way around. So I take this young man. Now, I knew he ran drugs, but I didn't know who for. It didn't, you know, it never mattered to me. But he was in a rehab that I actually was running at the time. So anyway, we take off, we go to Laredo. He watches me hit about three brick walls, and he's like, "Rusty, what is it that you want, really?" And I told him, I want to see who's doing this and how they're doing it, yada, yada, yada. 24 hours later, he had me standing in front of this guy who is dressed very nicely in blue jeans, boots, button-down shirt. Turns out this cat is a mid-level member of the Gulf Cartel, and they were like uncle and nephew together. He says, "Well, what do you guys want?" And my boy looks over at me and looks over at him. He says, "Well, he's doing a documentary about methamphetamines." And this guy said, "What do you want with me?" And I said, "I want everything. I want to see it. I want to film it, yada, yada, yada." His demeanor changed right then and there.
To what?
It was like this came over his face, like a seriousness, like, "Did I really hear that?
Right.
Is that really what this
okay.
fool wants?"
Yes.
He said, "I tell you what, I'm not going to do your interview for you, but I'll give you a couple of my boys." Now, check this out. I put part of that interview. It's my very first interview. I'd never interviewed a single soul in my life, okay? I put these two guys, I had brought an RV with me. It tells you how stupid I was. I'd drive that thing right into Mexico. So I've got this cat in my RV and these two guys.
Right.
So I put a mask on them, and the first guy was in charge of kidnappings and assassinations, and the other guy was in charge of distribution. And I'm just like,
were you scared?
I was over my head so far. I was like, I was a mumbling, bumbling idiot. I didn't know what to ask. So I asked the most direct question. And I'm like, well, you know, what are you doing when you kill these people? And you know, well, sometimes we, you know, tell you what, reading today's paper, you'll see what we did yesterday. Sure enough. You know, I picked up the paper, and there was like three killings, and just the way they told me that happened. And, you know, I was so over my head, and I mean, I had no idea. But I did realize this. By the time that interview was over, I knew that the story wasn't about the drugs. The story was about these guys. Why do they do what they do, and how do they do it? And so that's what the story became. I spent the next 2 years running with this cat. And I ran when they ran. There's many times I'd stay out with them for a week or two. There's times I just stayed for a day or two.
And why did they let you do this? I mean, I know you say they want the publicity, but I would think they might be concerned that you're a two-edged spy here or something.
It took about 6 months for me to get there. Okay.
Right. Okay.
They tested that, believe me. I don't even know in all the ways that they tested that, but I do know they did. And I can also tell you, at the time, they had a federal agent on their payroll. And this guy was talking to me, and they were seeing if I was going to divulge anything to him. And I didn't know it at the time.
Sure.
And see, here's the thing, and they all know this. I mean, everybody I've worked with knows this, even law enforcement. If I knew tonight that there was $20 million worth of cocaine crossing that bridge, I could tell you what vehicle, what time, yada, yada, yada. I'd never say a dadgum word. Never.
Because?
My life's not worth a load of coke. I don't care. If we bust it, we bust it. If we don't, we don't. I do not care. It is not worth my life. But if they were to put a green light, a hit, out on a cop or an agent or somebody like that, I'm going to say that. I'm going to roll on them. I can tell you right now. But they're not stupid enough to tell me something like that. Never one time. I was never put in a position where I saw an execution or anything like that. Nothing. Now, I was there just moments after sometimes. I can tell you that they performed a guiso, which is Mexican for, or Spanish, for stew. What they do is they rub axle grease all over your body.
Yeah.
They put you in a barrel, 55-gallon drum, and they pour diesel fuel all over you, and they light you on fire while you're alive. And that's called a guiso. They also, one particular group, I had been hearing these rumors about how these guys had lions, you know, and tigers, and that they were feeding people these things. And I never saw any evidence of that, right? So one night I'm in a bar, I'm there to meet somebody, and this kid comes in. He's like 18, 19-year-old kid. We know each other. He's involved. He said, Rusty, you got to see what we did last night. He flips out his cell phone, and he cues this thing up, and he shows me this guy that they stuck in a pen with this lion. And the lion, he's crying, by the way. The guy is just absolutely losing his mind. That lion swats him with his paw and knocks the guy to the ground. He starts screaming. That's when the lion takes a bite right out of his abdomen. I mean, the middle section of his body. I freaked out. Man, I just pushed him away. All right, you guys are really doing this stuff. Well, I ended up putting that in my film, okay, in Drug Wars. I have got an incident that I reenact, actually. But the lion was the most expensive actor I ever had, by the way. He was $15,000 a damn day. But anyway, had him brought in from California. But these guys had shown me, or told me about a story where they cut this kid's arm off and they threw it in the pen with the lion and they made him watch as this lion ate his arm. And they said, we're going to feed you to this lion one piece at a time if you don't tell us what we need to know. And that's exactly what they did.
You know, the mafia used to do it a finger at a time.
Right. Yeah, well, these guys, you know, they're into full amputations. You know, they don't do anything half-assed. They don't. They go all the way or not. It's one or the other. And, you know, it was I just knew that my government did not know what these guys were doing, because this was before any of this ever got reported. You know, where
this
they...
When? What years?
This was in 2006 and 7.
Okay.
And,
our government didn't know?
Well, I'm sure they did know.
Okay.
And that was part of what was disconcerting to me, was the fact that, wait a minute, you guys knew this was going on and you're not doing nothing about it? Are you kidding me?
I'm surprised you're still walking around.
Well,
not from the cartels aspect, from our government's aspect.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, the only work that I've ever done with the government is I go to various conferences and teach. I probably do 10 conferences a year, gang conferences, federal law enforcement conferences. My films are actually at the FBI Academy and part of the curriculum for new agents. Department of Homeland Security uses them for training. The Texas DPS, which is our state police, they use it for training. And I go all around the country, and I've got a little different perspective than your normal journalist or your normal expert, because I've been inside the belly of the beast and I live to tell about it. And since that time, I've embedded with every major cartel there is at some point. I didn't spend nearly as much time with them as I did these other guys, but I have embedded with them. And I can tell you that, some of these guys are no longer with us. You know, they're dead. The one thing about it is I never agreed with anything that they were doing. And they knew that. I understood it, but it doesn't mean I agreed with it. Now, on the other hand, I'm not stupid enough to do something that's going to get me killed. Because, look, they wouldn't have to have me in Mexico to kill me. They could do that walking out of my front door at home. In fact, that would be easier.
Because they're here in the United States.
Absolutely. And see, this was just on the edge of when they started really setting up their networks here. So my first film, Drug Wars, is all about how the cartels have evolved into what they are today and why they're doing what they're doing. You know, and one of the reasons, and let me just tell you, the biggest reason is money. The Mexican cartels have historically always been the wholesalers of narcotics in the United States. That market was worth $15 billion a year to them. That same $15 billion translates to $250 billion retail on the streets of America. That's the market they wanted. And that's the market they've come here to capture. And that's the market they have 85% of today. And the way they're doing it is, who handles the retail sales of narcotics in America? Street gangs, motorcycle gangs, prison gangs. Those are the ones that handle the majority of it. So what has the cartel done? They've come in here, and by using mergers and acquisitions, and instead of a ballpoint pen, they use a 9mm, and they merge or they acquire these gangs. And that's what you got.
I think I was reading something about the fact that that they prey on these kids to get them into these gangs. They don't have to already be gang-oriented. They actually can take, well, let's say, good kids.
And that's what they prefer now.
Okay.
Yeah. And now that's where Operation Detour comes in. That's my next film.
Okay.
Because that explains all of that. And I show example after example of how these kids get involved in this by being recruited.
American
kids, yeah.
We're not talking about Mexicans or Hispanics. We're talking about American kids.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And it doesn't matter what race they are, but they're Americans. And, you know, look, you take a 16-year-old U.S. citizen, little American teenager. He knows the language. he knows his way around. Nobody's going to suspect this kid. So the likelihood of him being profiled is slim to none. This is a kid that they can strap him with 100 pounds of pot, send him from the border, go to Dallas, Texas, pick up the money, and bring it home and pay him $2,000 to do it. That's more money than the kid than his parents make in a week. And he can do it on a weekend. They do this all the time. And now it's not a border issue. It's all over the country. And my film...
They weren't being able to get into the country to begin with, but it's gone too far.
Oh, absolutely.
That's, I think
yeah.
That's
the Department of Justice now admits that there's 3,300 cities across America that now have at least one cartel presence in their city. At least one. Most of them have 2, 3, 4, and 5.
But do we, the American public, know them as a cartel?
Well, probably not. You know, I'd say in some places people do know, but in most cases they don't. Now, I got to tell you, in Chicago, there's a DEA agent that runs the DEA station up there. His name is Jack Riley, and this is probably the most vocal, most candid DEA agent, especially at his level, that I've ever met. And I put him in that documentary because he comes right out and says, hey, look, the gangs are responsible for all the killings here. And, you know, they got
they're outrageous
8 murders a week or whatever it is. And who's in control of the gangs? The cartels. And that's why, you know, he knows and he admits freely on camera that these guys in the cartels are really pulling the strings on the street. It isn't these gangs doing it by themselves. They're doing exactly, cartels are doing exactly what the U.S. Army does in Afghanistan. We take an indigenous force, we train them, we give them weaponry, and we give them missions. And they go out and do the fighting. That's exactly what they're doing with these gangs and these kids that they bring in. They want those smart, affluent kids. Let me tell you what they use them for. If I'm running a cell of cartel guys and gang guys, right? I'm running my own little drug business. I don't run down to Office Max and get a copy of QuickBooks and start keeping track of what's going on. So what they do is they get these kids to handwrite software for them, both for communication as well as money laundering as well as keeping track. Then they need those laptops encrypted. So somebody's got to write that. So they use these kids to write software for them so that they can communicate, so they can launder money, because so much of it now is digital. And let me tell you what else they do. They'll take those like gift cards that you get at a store, say a Walmart card. They'll put, not at one time, but they'll go put $2,000 a day on this card. In very little time, they've got $100,000 on this card. They walk it across the bridge, and there's nothing we can do because we don't know it's there. Because when they walk cash across, that's got a smell to it, and a dog can hit it. Those cards don't. So it's the same as having hard, cold cash. So, I mean, and these kids set this all up for them.
And why do these kids do it?
Money.
Just because of money. Now, these are affluent kids.
They're told that they're not going to get in trouble. You know, you're not going to get in any trouble. They don't think they're doing anything wrong. I mean, what? They're writing some software. There's no law against that.
Well, what about the drugs, though? They know they're taking drugs across, don't they?
Well, sure. And the kids that are doing the smuggling. I'm just talking about the kids that they use.
You're talking about another tier.
Right.
Another tier.
Yeah,
there.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And, you know, I had interviewed the first kid that I interviewed was from Laredo, Texas. His name was Rosalio Retta, and Rosalio had 30 kills under his belt by the time he was 16. He started when he was 13. They recruited him straight up off the playground in Laredo, Texas. You can look this kid up. It's well documented, and I documented most of it. I got the only television interview he had done up to that point. I interviewed him for a show called Gangland I used to produce on the History Channel. Rosalio was trained at a training camp in northern Mexico. They trained those kids just like we would any special operations, the SEAL team or the Berets. These kids were, you know, they get up at 5 in the morning, they do physical training, then they do classes. They're taught how to kill with their hands. They're taught how to kill with a rifle, a pistol. They're taught how to perform certain assassination techniques.
Sounds like a different version of ISIS.
Yeah. It's a school. It is. That's the best way to characterize it. They have modeled themselves after the Middle Eastern terrorist groups. Absolutely. And whether that was by design or not, I couldn't really tell you. But that's the same kind of tactics that they use. Yes.
Wow. How do you deal with this yourself, personally? Knowing all this information and knowing that this is what is happening, how do you deal with this?
Well, you know, that's what caused me to make these documentaries. And, you know, I guess over the years, I've become desensitized to some of it. I got to tell you, it did become and has become very demoralizing sometimes because I have met with or testified on the Hill about 8 or 9 times. And every time I go in there, we show them a video, we testify. We turn on the lights and their little mouths are just wide open. We didn't know it was that bad. Oh, my God, what can we do? And we tell them what they need to do.
Yeah.
We tell them what they need to do and they do nothing. How long can you tolerate that?
Well, you can't.
So I took my case to the American people. And I decided that, you know, if Congress don't want to listen, they don't want to do anything. Because it's real simple. And this is about as far as I weigh in when it comes to immigration. If they would take the vote away from these illegals that they want to give amnesty to, this argument would be over tomorrow.
Because?
Because they wouldn't have the vote. That's all Congress is interested in. They don't care about anything else. They're fighting for those 11 million votes that they think is going to come with giving these people amnesty and citizenship. You take that out of the equation and say, yeah, we'll make you citizens, but you don't get to vote. And in my eyes, I don't think they should be able to collect Social Security, but I think they ought to have to pay into it.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you left Social Security there, take the vote away and Congress is going to pass new immigration laws tomorrow. That's all it would take. And, you know, I guess that's real simple for me to sit on the sidelines and say, mm-hmm. but...
Well, you haven't really been sitting on the sidelines now, Russ.
Well...
You've been in there, Russ.
Well, I kind of feel like it. You know what I'm saying?
I guess you would feel you're helpless to do anything about it. You know about it, but you as a man can't do anything to change the whole focus.
And it never really mattered how much proof I brought them. You know, I actually got into a gunfight one time. I was running with the Mexican military and the federal police. It was the only time I actually got into a real gunfight. And I got to tell you, I was scared to death. I mean, it's all Hollywood till the bullets start flying, let me tell you. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm cowering behind a vehicle.
Silver and lead, right?
Holding my camera up over the truck, you know, just filming what I can. But I've had some crazy times. I mean, in the very beginning, I had a lot of death threats.
And you kept doing it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you have to assess what's real? What is the real risk level of this? Well, first of all...
First, I think they said they're going to kill me. I think I'm out.
If they wanted to kill me, they wouldn't tell me. I'd never hear the shot that did it. That's the fact.
Because they throw you in with the lions.
Well, I wasn't looking forward to that either, you know.
Or then there's that stew thing that you were talking about.
Right.
All of those choices are bad choices.
Not any fun. Right. Right. So, you know, I guess, you know, from where I'm standing, to know that I've been able to do practically nothing, and I mean that. Now, I have been given an opportunity to share what I know with the people that have to do this on the front lines. I know that that information has helped tremendously. For that, I'm grateful. But it's not had the effect yet. And here's the thing. My life is really not in danger until somebody goes on CNN and says, Rusty Fleming's videos are why we're winning the war on drugs. Right. That's going to happen. You know what I'm saying? Pigs will fly before that happens. Okay. So and that's the only way, really and truly, that my life is in any real danger. I did have a guy within the Zeta organization who's now imprisoned. This guy did put a kidnapping order on me because he had just been indicted out of New York. He wanted to gather up everybody that they suspected had anything to do with this indictment. My name came up, so they wheel in the computer, and they start watching my greatest hits on YouTube, and I'm interviewing all these Zetas. And he's like, who the hell is this guy? And who the heck is working with him within our organization? I want him. He put a $450,000 bounty on my head to have me kidnapped and brought back to Mexico. I find out about it from the FBI. So I pretty well knew it was true. And fortunately for me, the guy they gave the kidnapping order happens to be the guy that cooperated with me at that time.
The DEA agent?
No, this was the guy inside the organization. Yeah. And he sent his brother, who's a U.S., he's actually a dual citizen, sent him to come talk to me and say, do not come back to Nuevo Laredo. Don't cross that bridge. They know who you are. They've got everybody in the world looking for you. And all they want is my name out of your mouth. And Rusty, if they find out it was me, they will tie me up, they will march my family in the living room, and they will execute my kids first, my wife next, and then they'll start torturing me. As if that wasn't going to be torture enough to watch
right.
them die.
Exactly.
That's exactly what he told me. Well,
how come you're still walking around?
Well, for one, he got imprisoned. The guy that put the green light on me.
Right.
Look. I would have been a trophy on his mantle.
Well, I'm telling you what, we've known for years the mafia. People have been in prison and still been doing their business.
Yeah, and Miguel probably is too. This cat's name is Miguel Trevino, and you can look him up. He's well published.
Well published.
Yeah. There's a lot of news on this guy, At the time, I would have been a trophy on his mantle. Okay, that's all. And I had nothing to do with this indictment, by the way. Absolutely nothing. I happened to be in New York, though, when this all went down.
Oh, so it didn't look good. That didn't look good.
No, it didn't. And my guy knew this. I don't know how the heck he knew it, but he knew it. They knew when I went to Guatemala, the NRA called me one bright, shiny day. Remember when Hillary and Barack said that 90% of the weapons that cartels use come from the U.S.?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we all knew that was 90% BS, but the NRA calls and said, hey, can you prove it? Can you disprove that theory? I said, heck yeah. So I ended up about a month later in Guatemala City, Guatemala, and I ended up getting inside this black market arms dealers operation. And I got this guy telling me, yeah, the Gulf Cartel and the Zetas are my two biggest customers. Heck yeah. And he's got a bunker that's got rifles, RPGs, 50 caliber machine guns, as far as you can see. And he's like, I ask him what he gets for these weapons. He gets $150 for an AK-47. Well, okay, let's do the math here. They're $1,000 over in the U.S., or I can buy them in Central America, which is awash with weapons because of all the civil wars they've had, for $150. Where do you think I'm going to get my guns? Of course, they do buy guns here in the U.S. If I'm running the Juarez cartel and I am, you know, right across the bridge from El Paso, Texas, of course I'm going to have somebody jump the bridge and go get me some guns. Absolutely. But is that where we get 90% of them? No. You know where they get 90% of their weapons?
Where?
It's from the Mexican military. They pay those guys off, and they get access to their warehouses. I can't tell you how many grenades that ATF, that these guys have used on this side of the border to blow up bars, to blow up houses. At any rate, ATF tracked these grenades, and they all came from the Mexican military. The Mexican,
well, why are we screwing around with
this? And guess what? They actually go back to being made in the USA. We sold them to South Korea. South Korea sold them to Mexico, and Mexico sold them to the cartel, and they get used on our side of the border. Now, it's not, you know, a wholesale use, but there's plenty of articles out there to back up what I'm saying. In McAllen, Texas, you know, they threw two of these grenades. Neither one of them went off because the idiots didn't pull the secondary pin. But doesn't matter. You know, they tried. That's just the reality of it, you know. And, you know, a lot of people would say, well, the reason we're not doing anything is they don't want to do anything. You know, there is some truth to be said that the drug war employs a lot of people. There's a lot of people that would be out of a job if there was no drug war.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Now, do I think that my president, even as weak as I believe this guy to be, do I think he's slinging dope off the back porch of the White House? No, I do not believe that. Nor do I believe that the DEA is running drugs. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you this, they're allowing it to be done. That, in fact, I do what's called forensic consulting. I get hired by defense attorneys to investigate cartel homicides on this side of the border. My job is to do the background investigation of the victim, of the perpetrators, yada, 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 everybody connected to a cartel. Mm-hmm. I do the background on them. I come back to court, and I explain it to the judge, to the jury, and that's my job. Okay, and that's what they pay me for, and they pay me really well, so I love doing it. Now, I just came out of a trial last month. One of the biggest cartel snitches that we've ever had. He got killed in South Lake, Texas, right just north of Fort Worth, broad daylight, executed 9 shots, all in upper body. This guy was running drugs. The DEA knew it, but he was giving them so much information at a level that they had never had before. He was setting up big-time drug lords in the other cartels. So if he was bringing in 50 or 100 keys a month, let him do it. And that's exactly what they did. Do you remember Fast and Furious?
Yes.
Okay.
Trey Gowdy is our congressman.
Great. All right, check this out. That was never about guns. That wasn't about guns. Wasn't about guns.
Okay.
You know what that was? That was.
I'm thinking drugs now, but.
Well, let me tell you what that was. We knew where those guns were going. We knew they were going to the Sinaloa cartel. That's the only major cartel working there. Oh, who do you think is going to get them? Okay. Those guns were traded for information. Here's the guns. Now, we want information on your rival cartels that are hauling dope. And that's what they did. They traded information for those guns. And that was going to serve another purpose, too. But
who traded them? Which department in the government?
Well, it was actually ATF at the behest of the DOJ.
Okay.
Yeah. And I actually interviewed the agent in charge of that operation, and this guy was sick. I mean, literally just sick about what happened. He said, you know, it went against everything we've ever been taught, everything we were ever trained to do, to let those guns walk, because that is not what we do, Rusty. And, you know,
it was still never been resolved.
No.
For the public, or, you know, the death of our...
the border agent that got killed with that gun, yeah.
Right.
And a lot of people don't realize this, but about half of those weapons crossed the bridge in El Paso. Well, I lived 5 years from 2009 till 2014, in just outside of El Paso, because I was producing multiple documentaries at the same time. And so I actually lived down there for for the past 4 years. And I can tell you that that border is anything but secure. You know, it's border insecurity where we come from, not security. And, you know, we've got a fence. Look, I lived in a county called Hudspeth County, which is adjacent to El Paso County. In our county, we have 98 miles of border.
Okay.
Butts right up against Mexico. We've got 7 miles of fence, and it's in the wrong damn place. Literally, I have video. I've posted it. You can find it under Rusty Fleming's Borderland.
Okay.
Okay, you got to look this up on YouTube.
Okay.
Okay, check this out. I literally walk up to that fence from the Mexican side.
Okay.
And there's that $1 million a foot fence. Or it was actually like $1 million a mile. But there's that high dollar concrete and steel fence. I do a real tight shot in the camera, and I'm saying, okay, look, I guess if I wanted to circumvent this fence, I could, you know, when we built a 15 foot fence, 16 foot ladders went on sale in Mexico, okay? and they sold out of those,
right,
okay?
Yes.
So I could either take a ladder and climb it. I could take a blowtorch. Okay, that's kind of hard. I take 3 steps to my left, and there's a 3-strand barbed wire fence that goes right up against the concrete and steel fence. And all I did was unhook it, lay it down, and walked right into the United States. Now, tell me how asinine that is.
All of it is. All of it is.
Of course it is.
You know, and I think the thing about it is we're allowing our country to be taken over and destroyed.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. Hello.
And we know, and everybody talks about, whether we know it from your perspective, but about the drugs that are in our community in Greenwood, South Carolina, or whether they're in New York or Chicago or anywhere else. I just don't understand, if you've been talking to government people, and that nothing happens. I know we had Congressman Jeff Duncan, who was on Homeland Security, and the Mexican, I'm not going to say the president, but the Mexican people, a group, were here, and they were talking to him about this. And I asked Jeff, I said, well, what the hell is being done? And he goes, well, they're working on it. I'm like,
yeah.
Okay.
They've had 40 years to tinker with this thing. You think you guys might come up with a plan? Let me just tell you, the thing I always heard every time I go to Mexico is, if you Americans didn't have the demand, we wouldn't be supplying it. Well, that's a weak excuse. I mean, look, yes, we could do better about demand reduction in this country, and that's really what a lot of my work has been pointed to for the last 5 years, is educating parents, the kids, teachers.
Because you've given up on the government doing
exactly,
anything about it?
Exactly. That's exactly right. So Sheriff West and I, the Sheriff West is the sheriff of Hudspeth County,
mm-hmm.
very dear friend of mine. He and I kind of band together, and we put all this together to take on the road and do a nationwide tour and basically show the films like Operation Detour and some of the other films I've done and educate these kids about two things. Number one, about the drugs. My program is DARE, the DARE program on steroids. Okay, that's what I show.
Mm-hmm.
These kids will mock anything that's not real. If it's not real, they'll just laugh at it.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen a single smile, much less a laugh, after they've watched what I show them, because I'm showing them the real deal. They're pretty shocked when it's done, and that's why I have to get school board just to approve these films to be shown. I invite the parents, and it's like watching a horror show. It really, and I'm showing what they're doing over here, not what they're doing over there. Forget what they're doing in Mexico. That doesn't have a direct effect on our kids today.
Correct.
What does is the fact that these yo-yos are already here, and they're trying to recruit these kids. And we try to show them, hey, look, kid, when you join, you just join your whole family into this gang, into this cartel. Let me tell you why. Because when you want to quit, when you want to get out, it ain't going to matter. And they're not going to grab you and torture you. They're going to grab your little sister. They're going to grab your mother. They're going to grab somebody close to you, and they're going to kill them. And you ain't going nowhere. And I show actual examples of that in that film.
It's like Scared Straight.
That would be a very good analogy.
And I think I was reading somewhere about that the kids today, they are too sophisticated for a lot of the programs that are out there. It almost has to be something. It's kind of like I've watched some of the shows. I don't know what channel it was on, and it's been a while since I've seen it, where they get these kids, adults, traveling in Europe or wherever, and they're strapping drugs on them and sending them in and out of our country.
Yeah.
Until they get caught by
law enforcement. Yeah.
And then when they're overseas, what happens to them? You know, I don't know if it has any effect on them or not. Because they just believe, I think our kids today just believe they're invincible, the same thing we believe.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's never changed.
Right.
I mean, that's always been like that.
I mean, you must have had a big case of feeling you were invincible.
Well, I used to say it either takes no brains or big cojones to do this. And I fall in the brain category more than anything.
Okay.
lack thereof. I didn't really have any good sense when I first started this. To really be honest with you, I took a lot of chances. I got better at it as time went on. You know, and of course, the motivation of these guys, it changed. When I was producing Gangland for the History Channel, I went across to Juarez, and I'm meeting with this guy, and I'm talking to him about what I'm doing. He says, well, what are you doing exactly? I said, well, I'm producing an episode of Gangland. He goes, Gangland? That's my favorite show, man. We was wondering if you were going to do an episode on us. What do you need? And I'm like, I'm going to need access to your guys. He said, you got it. I'm like, oh, Jesus, I got to get a new job. This is just not working out. Yeah. And they started treating me like a rock star. I'm not kidding you. And that is really the truth. And, you know, again, I'm going to say I'm the best press agent they ever had. When I produce a documentary, I'll be on CNN the next day, or I'll be on Fox, and I'm talking these guys up. And they love that stuff. They absolutely, and that's not why I do it, okay, because they like it, but that's why they let me in. And I don't care why they let me in, just let me in, you know. There's a lot of things that I couldn't film, wouldn't want to film, okay. And I told each and every one of them, no is a perfectly good answer, because I'm going to ask you for way more than you're willing to give me. And that's fine. You can just tell me no, and we'll go on to something else. But I'm going to ask. And I'll tell you one quick story. Early on, the first guy I met down in Louisville, Laredo, he had taken me through this meth factory they had, cranking out 2,000 kilos a week of crystal methamphetamine. We got done taking the tour of the plant, and he says, now what do you want? I mean, he was getting a little frustrated, you know, with me hanging on his shirt tail all day. And he says, what do you want now? And I said, well, I want to photograph or video you guys wrapping it up, loading it for transport, transporting it. I want to follow it to Dallas or wherever you're taking it. I want to film the whole thing.
Right.
He says, well, I'll tell you what. He says, give me that RV you're driving. Give me 3 days. I'll strap it with 1,000 keys of meth, and you can film the whole damn thing. And you take it to Dallas, I'll pay you $1,000 a key for it.
Yes?
I said, no, I don't think so. No. He said, that's the only way it's going to happen, my friend, because you are not going to film that. I said, good enough.
Good enough.
And actually, it was really funny when we did this. We both laughed about it, and, you know, this is also the same guy that told me some years later, this would have been about 2008 or 9, he said, you know, Rusty, I've got a stash house in San Antonio, and there's about $8 million stashed in that house. I really need to invest it in something. He said, why don't you go through San Antonio and pick up that money and put it in your production company, and let's do some good stuff together. And I said, Juan, not in a million years would I do that. And he said, why? Well, you know, he was almost like he was offended. I said, because one day you're going to call me for a favor, and it ain't going to matter that I don't want to do it. I'm going to have to do it. And he
just like the mafia.
He smiled at me and he said, "You're not as dumb as you look." And I no way did I ever want these guys, you know, me owing them a favor. So I made damn sure they owed me the favor, you know. And I got a lot of cooperation, not just from the cartels, but from the military, from the federal police down there.
In Mexico,
yeah.
The Mexican people.
And, you know, a lot of those guys were on cartel payroll, okay? And it is what it is. And, you know, the federal police chief at the time, 2007, he was commander over all federal forces in Mexico. He and I became pretty good friends. And as a gift, I gave him a nickel-plated 45 caliber pistol. Had his name engraved on it and all this stuff. Well, you would have thought that I just bared his first child. I mean, he loved me after that. Well, one night, I had these two guys that were trying to abduct me and the guy that was with me. They were in plain clothes. They flashed their badges at us. And I looked at my friend and I said, "They are not arresting us. They told us we were under arrest." I said, "They're trying to kidnap us." And I pulled out this guy's card of the police commander. And I said, "Before you take me, you call this man right here and make sure he wants me kidnapped tonight." One of them turned around, took about 3 paces back. He calls the number. He comes back, hands me the card back. They turn around, and I never saw him again.
You know, this stuff is just, you know, it's hard to believe, Rusty.
I understand.
I mean, you know, sure. I think a lot of our listeners out there are probably sitting there going, Ann has finally flipped. She finally got somebody on the air, and she has no idea what she's talking about here, and is he to be believed, you know?
Well, you know, I guess you can look it up, you know, and that's what I tell everybody, because a lot of this is public knowledge now. Mm-hmm. Some of it.
Was it at the time?
Not exactly. You know, I was bringing home at the very time I was doing this. This is before CNN or anybody even started reporting this stuff. In fact, when I first came out with Drug Wars, I had people, producers at the news stations telling me that I was a fear monger, that I, you know, this is BS, this ain't happening. And it was about 3 or 4 months later when one of the stories that I tell in Drug Wars came out in the news, and it was an acid bath. They hijacked a load of sulfuric acid, or hydrochloric acid, one or the other. Anyway, I think it was sulfuric. And they would put people in that vat of acid, and they turn them into liquid DNA in about 72 hours. They call that the bath. There was a guy in Tijuana that they busted who claimed to have given 380 people the bath. And they had barrel after barrel after barrel of bodies that he still was working on. When that came out, I got more apologies sent to me than you could write a story about. They were like, "Sorry we ever doubted you, man." You know, and all the other things that I'd been reporting were happening, and they were coming out in the news. And these guys, they all of a sudden, "We need you." You know, I have worked with Anderson Cooper. Mm-hmm. I've worked with Geraldo Rivera. Mm-hmm. Anytime those guys wanted to go across and do cartel interviews or a big story on cartels, they take me. I produce the segments for them.
You're the man behind the scenes.
You got it. And see, I just have a different perspective than everybody else because I've been inside. That's really, and I'm stupid enough to have contacts, you know, there.
You got your little black book? Well, let me see. We can call so-and-so.
Something very similar to that. Not too far off there, Annie. Yeah.
Wow. So as you look at this and see what the situation is coming from the perspective that you know and you are telling us about here today, the future of our country.
You know what? If we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to keep getting what we're getting. That's about all I can say about that. We're going very rapidly down the express elevator to hell, and that's the way I look at it. And it isn't just because of the drug issue, because nothing has changed in the, quote, war on drugs since 1974 when Nixon came out with the DEA. Nothing has changed. We're never going to arrest our way out of this problem, and it ain't going to happen. We're going to have to come up with some new tactics here. And there's people way smarter than Rusty Fleming that have gamed those scenarios out that know a hell of a lot more about that than I do. You know, I've got some suggestions, yes, but as far as knowing how to fix this issue, I don't. I can give you, you know, some background information and statistical information, but that's about it. But that's only one aspect.
Okay.
You know, this particular administration, my personal belief is this man has done more damage than it's going to take three presidents to fix. And I don't know that we'll ever be able to turn our country around. We might slow it down. We might get off the express elevator and take the escalator. But we're still. I'll just tell you. I've been in some high-level meetings with Department of Homeland Security and some of the other agencies. And these guys are fed up with not being able to do their jobs. Because all the rules of engagement come from the White House. They got to live with it.
Absolutely they do.
Yep.
And that's the problem.
That's the problem. Right there.
And if we can't change out our Congress, change out our Senate, change out our President, we are never going to get anywhere.
We're never going to get there. That's right.
You know, there was a time where the Mafia was very feared in this country. And not everywhere, but in a large part of our country, the Mafia was very much... And they were able to do that. But I just don't see the will of the people or the will of the country.
Not yet. The political will is not there. And they're playing political games with our national security when it comes right down to it. And that's messed up. That is messed up. That is pure politics down there. That's the only thing keeping that border open like it is. The only thing. Politics.
Do you think Trump can do anything?
It doesn't matter what he does. You know, and, you know, I don't care who pays for the flipping wall.
The friggin' fence.
Yeah. I mean, he'll build it cheaper than anybody else can. Our government can do, you know, he can do with $10 what our government can do with $10 million. You know, and they don't get that. They don't.
No, I don't think they ever will.
No.
No.
In this town, you have to check your common sense at the door. And then you can go down to Capitol Hill and go see the rest of the Kool-Aid drinkers and, you know, those guys.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Rusty Fleming, you know, I've sat here most of the time, and if you see the video, you'll see my mouth open most of the time because these are things that you don't want to believe are true. I mean, nobody wants to believe that. Nobody wants to believe that their child could be... pushed into this and then take their family. And, you know, I think we're in South Carolina. We have drug issues. We don't have anything as some of the other areas do.
Right.
But one of the things our sheriff, our police, everybody is always telling, it's coming, and we keep hearing it's coming, and it is getting worse in our part of the country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. South Carolina, North Carolina are two hubs, and they're right outside of Atlanta.
Right.
Okay, and Atlanta is the major East Coast hub right there. And it's coming right to your town. There's no doubt about it. No doubt about it. Listen, I want to plug my website.
Okay, great.
Where people can go to get my DVDs.
Okay.
They can buy Operation Detour and Drug Wars and the book that I've written, Narco Warfare in the 21st Century. That's where I write about getting inside the first cartel I got in and how brain dead I was when I did that.
Did you ever do drugs?
Oh, yeah. I, in fact, in 1996, I was living in a dumpster, which is why...
Why did I think that? Yeah.
Yeah, I sure was. I went through 5 rehabs, 2 insane asylums. I was an alcoholic and drug addict, and in 1996, I was living in a dumpster eating out of trash cans. And I made a miraculous turnaround through, thank God, through some very loving people. down in Central Texas, a place called Christian Farms. I stayed there 6 months, and my life has never been the same. And in 1999, I started a faith-based rehab in Dallas. And I've got one in West Texas now. We've got about 80 beds. And, that has been the brightest spot of my life. What I do in production and the consulting and all of that, that's just marking time on a wall. It's what I do to make a living. My true heart, my true passion is with working with drug addicts and their families. And
it's a huge problem.
Oh, yeah.
It's a huge problem. And we can't seem to get ahead of it.
No, not the way we're doing it, Ann. We're going to have, I keep saying, the one thing is you have to admit you got a problem in order to find a solution. And that's the first thing. And, our government couldn't find a problem, okay, with two hands and a flashlight. They couldn't grab their butts, okay? So, that's what you start with.
And that's where we need the people.
Exactly.
The people. Well, I think it's an amazing story. What's your website so people can check it out?
It's Rusty Fleming, FLEMING, 1M, Rusty Fleming Consulting.com.
Okay.
Rusty Fleming Consulting.com. Maybe you guys could put it on your Facebook page or something.
We will. We're
going to
put it on the Facebook
page
with it. Yeah, we will.
Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, do you sleep well every night?
I do now. I do now. When I was running with those guys, they don't carry 9 to 5 hours.
Right.
That it was a good thing I was a younger man doing that. But, it's not as inherently dangerous as people might think.
Now, I say that,
and, it depends upon your definition of dangerous, I took a lot of risks. I did. Do I now? Not so much. I still utilize a lot of my contacts to do what I do in the consulting area, but, it's not like I'm down there with a film crew and filming all that stuff.
Okay, final question. Do you look over your shoulder?
Not very often.
Not very often.
Not very often.
Rusty Fleming, director of Drug Wars, and that website again?
RustyFlemingConsulting.com.
Y'all need to check it out, and we'll be talking. I hope we can maybe get a hold of you again sometime.
I hope
you do. Happy to have you on the radio.
I want to give you a couple of copies of the DVDs. Would
Great.
Love for you to watch those.
Great.
Okay, and then you can get me back on.
We'll talk
on
about
the phone
it.
And we'll do it.
Sounds great.
All right.
Hey, let's hear a word from our sponsors. We'll be right back. We got more guests. Whew, I'm exhausted. I'll be right back. This is WCRS 98.5 1450 right here in Washington, D.C., live right here. Bye-bye. I'll be back. Don't go away. What did I say bye-bye for? I'll be back.
Gold. Gold. More precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
A continuation of Meet Me at the Diner, and we have right here with us Chris Farrell. He is the Director of Research and Investigations Judicial. Chris Cabrera. God almighty, that's the other guy. Sorry. Chris Cabrera, Border Patrol Agent, National Border Patrol Council Spokesman. You live in Texas, is that right?
Yes, ma'am, South Texas.
Well, we were just talking with Rusty Fleming. Have you heard any of the things that Rusty has had to say?
I heard a little bit of what was going on right now.
Yeah? Absolutely frightening.
Yeah, it is. It is. I think once the general public catches on to what's actually happening down there on the border and the fact that it's coming this way into the rest of America, people will be quite surprised and quite eager to learn.
Well, I can't think of anybody from the drug aspect, which we were just talking about with Rusty, that hasn't been affected by it. I mean, everybody knows somebody that has OD'd, somebody that's hooked on drugs, is addicted, has been through rehab, can't make it away from it. I mean, and that's just one. What that's one part of the issue.
Yeah, that's one part. You have the home invasions with the cartels stealing each other's product and the aftermath of what happens if they hit the wrong house or they hit the house when women and children are in there. There's just tons of things that can go wrong.
So what exactly, as the National Border Patrol Council spokesperson, what exactly do you do? And I would presume that you have worked on Border Patrol and now have been elevated to a spokesman?
Well, I am a Border Patrol agent. I work as a Border Patrol agent, and I'm also union representative, and I'm also a spokesman for the National Union. So kind of three hats there.
What do you think are the most important things? What is the most important thing that the general public needs to know about the Border Patrol?
You know, our hands are tied. We do what we do. We work hard. However, the laws are not being enforced. People are coming across, and instead of them being removed back to their country, their home country, they're allowed to stay. And it creates a waterfall effect. I mean, more and more people are coming because they know their family and friends just came through and they just got released. So they call home, five more come. They call home, even more come, and they get into the country. They stay in the country. There's no court dates pending because we're so backlogged. I think it's a 5 or 6 year backlog. And so they're allowed to stay. And then once they get into a sanctuary city, they'll never be seen again.
As a border agent, as a Border Patrol agent, I mean, that has to be very demoralizing for you day in and day out. And I'm sure people are saying, why the hell aren't you doing your job?
Well, you know, we do our job. The unfortunate part is, while we make the arrest, but when it comes to removing them, that's no longer in our hands. And instead of being removed, we transfer them over to the other agencies and they're forced to release them. The other part of that is the folks that we see coming across. Well, we have the bad guys that come across, but we also have a lot of women and children that are turning themselves in. And recently, we've seen a lot of unaccompanied children this year.
Last year, when we had them coming in by the trainload.
Yeah, oh, we had, and this year we've already eclipsed last year's numbers.
For real?
Yeah, for real.
How come that's not in the media?
I guess what they're saying is 2016 is busier than 2015, but it's not as bad as 14. But what they don't understand is better than bad is not good. You know, the other thing is the unaccompanied kids, what we're seeing now, and we saw three cases this year already, a two-year-old left by herself on the river, a two-year-old female, and then a two-year-old male, and then a four-year-old girl all alone with their name written in a Sharpie and a phone number on their shirt and just in the woods by themselves.
What do you do?
You know, you bring them into the station. Unfortunately, they end up getting reunited with their parents. And I don't agree with that. If your parent is going to put you up in a position where you're crossing four countries on top of a train by yourself, it doesn't seem like a fit parent to me.
It's not. And don't we actually have laws on the books to deal with that?
Yeah, we don't enforce them. You know, apparently child endangerment only applies to U.S. citizens, I guess. I don't know, because we don't enforce it on anybody else.
What about the drug part of it, Chris?
The drugs are everywhere. Mexico has taken over Colombia's role as far as bringing cocaine into the country. They're bringing meth. They're bringing heroin. You name it. The Mexican cartels are bringing it. And they're bringing a lot of violence with them. They're stealing each other's drugs along the border. They're stealing each other's people along the border. The illegal aliens they cross, they're called rip crews. They go in there and they take them from other smugglers. And a lot of times people end up dying.
Now, you're in Texas.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. I understand in Arizona, the congresswoman that was, that she has helped slow down as far as the immigrants come, the illegals coming across the border. Drugs are still very much a big problem. In Texas, have you seen any reduction in that aspect of it or
as
not?
As far as the people?
Yes.
We're leading the nation as far as human trafficking coming through our area, and we'll probably eclipse the 2014 numbers. It's just unreal. The scary part is what we catch is probably only 40% of what actually crosses.
Now, one of the things that I had heard is that you had Border Patrol agents had actually been moved back from the border I'm just quoting a number, but back from the border so that you can't even catch them on the border.
Well, you know, in some states it's different. With where we're at, we're lucky that we have the river there, so we can forward deploy and be close to it. And in our areas, we actually have people that patrol the river by boat. Unfortunately, we don't have enough of them. We have the boats. We just don't have the manpower to staff those boats. Now, we do have some out there. So in our areas, we are more forward deployed, but I know some of the more remote areas like farther west Texas, Arizona, those guys have to pull back a little for whatever reason.
What's the answer, Chris?
You know, the consequence delivery system. You enforce the laws that are on the books. You do a mandatory detention, mandatory removal. We've done it before. It worked like a charm. In 2006, I believe, we had an influx of Brazilians and Hondurans coming in. They did a program called the expedited removal. You come in, you're here about 3 days, and you're back in your home country. And that thing, it was like turning off a water spout. It just, overnight, it just stopped. A lot of tears the first day because they realized they weren't getting released. But after the third day, all you could hear was crickets.
You know, that brings an interesting point, because what is happening in Washington here, they're talking about they're going to build a taller wall around the White House. And my feeling is that if the Secret Service had shot somebody or done what was necessary, people wouldn't be jumping over the wall and we wouldn't be doing this. Sounds like the same type of thing as far as immigration down there on the border.
Yeah, you know, they are proposing putting the wall from end to end down there, and it would be a good tool to have as far as one of the tools in our toolbox as far as stopping it. But we also need to have the surveillance. We need to have the boots on the ground, the camp space, and the political will. When they first put that 18-foot wall out there, for the next couple of weeks, all we found were 19-foot ladders. I mean, these guys were there were so many ladders, they had to tell us to stop bringing them to the station because they were just everywhere in the behind the station. So.
You know, it seems like that the American public should know more about this, and I'm a news junkie. I'll just tell you, I'm a news junkie. I'm in this business. I look for this type of stuff. You don't see this in the news.
Yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, it's going to start becoming more and more commonplace that we're talking about people, victims of crimes by illegal aliens, those folks that we're here talking about, their loved ones that were killed by illegal aliens. That's just heartbreaking. And we're going to hear more and more about it. Granted, illegals aren't the only ones that do crimes in this country. But we have enough criminals already. We don't need to import any more. The way it's going, though, is more and more people are coming in. They're spreading out throughout the country. And they have no intention of leaving anytime soon.
You know, one of the things that I wanted to talk to the other Border Patrol guy that was here, he was telling me, we were talking to Ed, the rancher, and that there is Army base.
Fort Huachuca.
Right. And that they come right and walk right across the base, and the Army doesn't do anything, the Border Patrol doesn't do anything. And he looked at me, and he goes, that's absolutely true. And yet Americans, if they walked across the base, they would get picked up.
Yeah, exactly. You know, another thing is we have incursions by the Mexican military down where we're at, where Mexican soldiers will hit U.S. soil. And not only are they not prosecuted, there's not even paperwork generated. They just take them back to Mexico with their rifles and their military gear and, hey, don't do it again. And when you do it again, we'll tell you not to do it again. It happens all the time. You know, we have incursions quite a bit down there, whether it's in Texas, Arizona. They come across, and there's no repercussion, so there's no deterrent to do it.
How many border agents are there?
Around 18,000.
18,000, and that they work, what, from Arizona through Texas?
We have from Brownsville, Texas, all the way to San Diego, and then northern border from Maine to Washington State. We have some coastal agents from Florida to Houston area, New Orleans, that type of stuff. And then, you know, anywhere in between, we have, you know, air units, we have boat units. We have quite a bit.
Now, along our northern border, what's the situation there?
You know, I think what I was told is it's pretty few and far between that you have the agents up there. And I think it's one agent for every 25 linear miles, which... You know, 25 linear miles, you would think you could get there in 25 minutes, but the way the roads and the hills and the curves, it's more about an hour drive from point A to point B.
So are we having as many, are we having people come across the border there?
Yeah, there's people that come across there.
But we never really hear about that,
yeah,
do we?
You,
no.
Yeah, you never hear about it. And, you know, there's areas on the southern border the same way that they're remote. They're, you know, people are tied up doing the babysitting duties. So large groups of people are coming through and nobody's out there to stop them.
What about the tunnels? The tunnels. I mean, I've heard about the tunnels. I've read about the tunnels. What about the tunnels? Are you seeing tunnels there?
You know, in South Texas, since we have the river, there has been a couple, very few. Usually they're drainage tunnels. The interesting thing is they're already in place. It's, you know, like a water runoff. And so you have no idea where they're coming up. And they'll have a van with a false bottom park over a manhole, just like a cartoon. And then the manhole comes off, and they just start throwing bundles from the manhole into the van, and the van drives away. And, you know, unless you're really paying attention, it's kind of weird. You know, it's like some Wile E. Coyote stuff.
As a group, how does the group feel, the Border Patrol agents? How do they feel? I mean, I would think that it would be very demoralizing to be trying to do a job and you're not able to do the job that you need to do, and yet you know how to do the job.
Yeah, you know, it does get demoralizing because we have a job that we want to do, and we're not allowed to do it. Now, we still go out there and you compartmentalize and you take each task as it comes and put your heart into everything you do, and then you see some of the things that happens to these women and these children, some of the horrors that they go through. And then you look at the fact that our union's probably the only union in the history of unions that went and asked for more work. You know, we're here. Give us more to do. Most unions are saying, hey, you know, slow down, give us another coffee break. We're like, hey, let us do some more. Let us go. And it's kind of weird that we're over here pushing to get more work and they want less work out of us.
Who wants less work out of you?
The administration. I mean, if you look at it, there's laws that they don't want to enforce. They don't want us to catch these people, and when we do catch them, they don't want us to return them. They want us to, hey, let it go. It's low priority. And to us,
low priority.
Yeah, and to us, everything is a priority.
All right, Chris, what's the answer to all this?
The answer would be, like we said, you need to enforce the laws. And you need mandatory detention, mandatory removal. Once you do that, it's dried up.
The Border Patrol, the union, are they supporting Donald Trump?
The union did come out and support, they endorsed Donald Trump.
Do you think Donald Trump can make a difference?
You know, I think he can. You know, I think it's time for somebody to shake things up, you know. I don't know if he'll be good or if he'll be bad. Nobody will know until the time comes, but we've tried the same solution over and over and over, and it's got us nowhere. So maybe we need somebody from the outside to come in and shake it up a little, and hopefully it works, and, you know, pray for the best.
You know, I've been told about the signs that are in, I don't know if they're in Texas, I presume they probably are, that the government has put up that it's not safe for Americans to be in certain parts of Arizona.
Yeah, that's true. You know,
do you have the signs there in Texas?
We do have some signs. You know, interestingly enough, there's a little park birding center where we live. There's a lot of birds that go south for the winter. That's where they go to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so people go and they flock to these places. And my daughter years ago, she told me that she was having a field trip to one of these birding centers. And I told her, yeah, you know what? You're not going. You know, and she said, why? I said, it's dangerous. People get robbed down there all the time. And she said, well, I'm going with my school. I said, well, you're a bunch of third graders. You're not going down there. You know, so I said, look, the only way you go is if I go with you. And so she ended up staying home that day. But it wasn't because I didn't want her learning about birds. It's just not
dangerous.
A safe area. And I see it on a daily basis, what happens down there to men, women, children. I see it. And I don't want her to, and this was years ago. She's 16 now, but I didn't want her exposed to that.
So and the problem has not gotten any better.
No, it's gotten worse. It's gotten worse. You know, when you have girls, you know, 14, 15 years old that travel with the Plan B pill because they know that being violated is part of the journey, that's unacceptable.
That is unacceptable. Yeah. What is your background?
Well, I was in the Army. Did a little time in Hawaii, not a bad place to be stationed.
Right.
And I got out and, you know, was living in San Antonio at the time. I didn't even know there was a Border Patrol. And they told me, hey, you know, we have this this Border Patrol job. Do you want it? And I said, well, what do I get to do? He said, well, it's like playing hide-and-go-seek with people that don't speak English. You know, you get to chase people all day long. Okay, sign me up. You know, I had no idea, and it's a great job. I love it. I tell my kids it's like being a kid again, except I have good toys.
You have the real thing.
Yeah, you know, I get to go four-wheeling when I want and drive on a boat. And I can't fish, but, you know, I get to go down there and play around every now and then.
You know, I think I personally have had a real eye-opening. I mean, talking to the ranchers between last year and this year, and now talking to Border Patrol and Rusty Fleming and some of the others, how is the drug problem where you are in Texas?
Well, you know, a lot of the drugs that comes in is just passing through. We do see people that, you know, get affected with, you know, with the home invasions and stuff like that and the car chases. But I think as a community, our community has fared fairly well. I mean, we don't have a big epidemic. You know, we do have people that use marijuana or cocaine or whatever, but it's not anywhere near like a large city.
And it's not the cartels don't have the hold on the community?
Well, I think a lot of it is they're trying to move it north.
Oh, okay.
You know, they're just
trying to move
it
to South Carolina.
Yeah, and you know, that's the thing is we're on the side of the parade, and the parade's marching north to your part of the country. And we're just watching it go through, you know, not necessarily me as a Border Patrol agent,
right.
But the community there, it's just passing them by. Granted, some does stay, but the bad stuff is coming up here. You know, whether it's Austin, Houston, San Antonio, we see a lot in Virginia, D.C., Maryland, especially with the criminal gangs. And then Georgia sees a lot of cartel activity, especially Atlanta. I know the Carolinas see a lot. It's everywhere, and it's an epidemic, and it needs to stop, and granted, you can't stop everything, but if you can just start scaling back one piece at a time, why not?
If you can have consequences.
Yeah, and why not start somewhere instead of throwing your hands up and saying, well, nothing you can do about it. Well, you just quit. You know, you can't quit. You got to keep pushing and fix what you can and get the rest later.
Absolutely. Well, I know you have another appointment. I sure appreciate you coming in and talking to us, Chris Cabrera. God bless what you do, and let's hope that there's a change, that maybe we can stop some of this so we can save our country.
I hope so, and anytime you want to talk or whatever the case may be, give me a call. Maybe I'll send you some good pictures from out there.
That would be great. Hey, let's hear a quick word from our sponsor, South Carolina News, and I'll be right back.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafe cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafe mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
But I am live, and Bob is here, and he's going to take off his headphones because he just doesn't need it. It's the end of the day. Bob Dane, you are the executive director of FAIR, and I tell you what, it has been a fantastic FAIR. My head is spinning. I can't even tell you all the things I've heard. I feel like the cartel might be coming after me.
Oh, my goodness. It's such a delight to have you. This is now year number two.
It is.
We've been doing this for 10 years. I hope you'll be here on our 12th year.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. Believe me, I sure am. I tell you what, as you've listened and talked to everybody and everything, what have you thought about this year's fair?
You know, it kind of confirmed a few things. You know, I have learned more about what I've been wrong about this year than what I've been right about. And I guess I'm not alone because I think this has been such an extraordinary year. A lot of the pundits got it wrong. You know, I started this year in thinking that because there was such a pent-up appetite for more conservatism in the White House, in Congress, that Ted Cruz would have been a slam dunk. What I missed, and shame on me because I had an immigration organization, is the fact that the broad middle class is well aware of this failed experiment of globalization. You cannot export all of your manufacturing over the course of decades while you simultaneously import cheap foreign labor and have any kind of integrity or robust jobs market. I mean, that's a cash-in and a way to pad the pockets for the elites. It is the road to ruin for all of us, and I think Trump sort of tapped into that and felt that. And I guess we have all underestimated the public's outrage on immigration, which is now, it's not only just an issue, Ann, it's the most transformational determinant of where we are heading as a country, the policy decisions we make about immigration.
And do you think we're going to make those policy transformations?
Well, today we had a very good decision in the Supreme Court. To make a long story short, they've taken the ink out of the president's pen and unplugged his phone temporarily. So amnesty is not moving forward. But here's the challenge, Ann. The Supreme Court certainly stopped Obama's amnesty, but that Supreme Court decision doesn't have anything to do with Obama's continued negligence, his thwarting of the rule of law, and the continued dismantling of interior and perimeter enforcement. Nor does that decision compel Congress to act, which they should and they must, because it's Congress's job to, as our Constitution says, establish a uniform act of naturalization. So Congress needs to reassert their authority.
And but we have laws on the books, Bob.
We have laws. Look, you know, you hit the nail on the head. The first step towards reform is simply enforcing the laws that we already have, secure the border, and dry up the incentives that draw so many illegal aliens to the country and cause them to stay. And that includes the full honeypot of benefits, the spectrum from sanctuary cities, the availability of jobs, in-state tuition, and the like.
And in California, you can become a doctor, a lawyer, and, you know, any of these things. You can practice law. You can get a driver's license.
It's astonishing. I was outraged when I heard that. I mean, a professional licensing bureau for a trade or a profession exists to maintain and enhance the integrity.
In,
let's say it together again. The
integrity
right? of an organization. And besides, where are the limits? I mean, if somebody can be licensed who's not even authorized to work in the country as an electrician or a member of the bar, why not an airline pilot?
Well, wait a minute. No. Why not the president?
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, there are supposed to be limits on that, but I'm sure that'll be tested.
Sure. Look, it's the right and the responsibility of every country to not only define the principle of immigration, which we haven't done, which, by the way, in case anyone's wondering, the true purpose of immigration is to serve our broad national interest, not to pad the pockets of corporate elites trying to throw the American worker out the front door while they usher in foreign workers in the back door, nor is it used or should be used to alter the electorate by Democrats to create a big fat voter drive to serve our broad national interest. That's what FAIR is about. And I'm very proud, Ann, that FAIR has never will take a dime from a corporate interest and not a dime from either political party. We exist. We're one of the few organizations here in Washington, and there's a lot of public policy organizations. We're one of the few that truly exist on behalf of the American public.
So where does your money come from, Bob?
The wide swath of about 250 members and activists, concerned Americans who want to uphold the rule of law, protect their jobs, enhance the middle class, some foundations, and a few private donors.
That's pretty awesome, isn't it?
It's an honor to work for FAIR. You know, where we are heading as a country is, where we have always been has been defined by immigration. Where we are heading may be defined by immigration. There's nothing the matter with immigration. We're not anti-immigrant any more than somebody who's on a diet is anti-food. But we have a right, and we have a responsibility to define some limiting principle with immigration. Otherwise, it's an open turnstile, and you literally collapse the integrity of your markets and your culture.
Well, you know, it's like when I was talking to Chris with the Border Patrol. He said it's very simple. Just enforce. Let us enforce the laws. Send them back.
Right. I would say it's our responsibility moving forward between now and the elections. I mean, FAIR does not endorse a political candidate. But for the American public, there's never been such a stark choice on the policy immigration issues. We've never had such a stark choice between the two candidates. Trump's plan is pretty good. Mm-hmm. He needs to fill in some detail. We're working right. very hard on a transition document for the next president. Hillary's plan is basically doubling down on what Obama has done. And can you imagine, now in light of the Supreme Court decision today, which just slap down Obama's executive amnesty. Now, what's the Clinton? What are the Clinton strategists doing today? Because her whole policy orientation on the hottest issue in the country, immigration, was simply doing more of what Obama has been doing by executive action.
I heard her say yesterday or day before about creating a level playing field, make those immigrants legal so that they would pay taxes and make it legal for everybody.
I like the level playing field idea, but I have a little different approach to it. Let's level the playing field for the American worker who feels put upon.
Just for Americans. How about that?
Hey, yeah. You know, first we were told that there weren't enough Americans to do the low-end service jobs. That was never true. It is a lie. Americans will do any job provided their wages and working conditions are good, but when you flood the country, it's pretty hard to do. Now we're being told that at the upper chain of the labor, on the upper echelon of labor, science, technology, engineering, and math, there's not enough Americans to do that. That also is a lie.
Well, basically, because they're displacing workers with cheaper labor.
Sure, and I think the American public is starting to connect the dots that this isn't about filling voids, which are fiction. It is about replacing wholesale the entire labor force of the United States. You can't do that and survive as a country. And speaking of the high-end jobs, I mean, imagine if you're a mom and dad and you just plop down $150,000 and got your kid through, let's say, MIT for science, engineering, technology, or math, and now Johnny or Susie go out in the real world, try to get a job, and guess what? They're discovering the elites now. This issue is, the chickens are coming home to roost. This issue is now in their backyard because for the elites who are sending their kid to good or Ivy League schools, kids come out and they have to compete against labor from China, Pakistan, and India. It's not ethical. It's not moral. It's not inevitable. We can change it.
Well, we need to do something about that. We need to do something about the Muslims. 852,000 is what the figure I think I heard that are coming in from the Middle East. A majority of them, and President Obama wants to bring it up to 1 million, or they say it'll be 1 million before the end of the year.
Yes. Immigration is increasingly becoming a national security issue. I mean, the shooting in Orlando, I think, proved that someone who adheres to a radical interpretation of their Islamic faith are not practicing a religion. They're practicing a violent ideology, which it is when it's interpreted as a radical, radically interpreted. And it seeks the overthrow of the Constitution and supplant it with Sharia law. Now, that person is not fit to become a citizen. So if they cannot adhere to the Constitution and civility in the public square and become a citizen, why would we allow them in the country to begin with? Now, I want to be very clear. FAIR is not at the point where we're suggesting a total ban on Muslim immigration. We don't need to do that before we do. There's unfinished business to take care of first. Finishing the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. We still haven't finished real ID. We need to secure the border. Reduce immigration overall. It will help us statistically. Yes, reduce immigration from high-risk countries that have high rates of terrorism. Do a better job of screening. Eliminate the visa waiver program. There's a lot we can do before we need to get to that point. But if we continue on this trajectory, we are looking at a very difficult decision of balancing religious faith and freedom of religion, extremely core concepts of our Constitution, and balancing that off with national security concerns.
I want to ask you one last question. Yesterday there were these demonstrators outside and said that FAIR were haters. Wasn't that what they were saying? I think it's something to address, you know, because it is in there. What is your position on this?
Well, most of the opposition seeks to really shut down the debate, and there's no better way to do that than ad hominem attacks. We are not intimidated by that. We have nothing to apologize for. FAIR has a deep abiding belief that immigration policy shouldn't discriminate on the basis of race, creed, color, even country of national origin. Again, we're not anti-immigrant. We're focused. If we're mad, if we have outrage about anyone or anything, it's the do-nothing Congress that has failed to rein in a president that violates the law and
continues to violate it.
Yes.
Has no compunction about it and realizes that his time is limited.
Right. And any group that advocates on behalf of the American public for reasonable enforcement of rational laws, often called a hate group, look, let's be clear, there's such a thing as a hate crime. That exists in U.S. statute. But there's no such thing as a hate group except as it's defined by the Southern Poverty Law Center. They themselves have come up with the term hate group, which isn't that lovely. It gives them the complete license and privilege of becoming a judge and a jury and a prosecutor all at the same time. It's tyranny. It's abridging our free speech. And, you just roll with the punches.
Absolutely. And you know what? That's why fair. It's very fair, isn't it?
Where's the fairness in throwing the American worker under the bus? Where is the fairness in allowing an important policy decision like a policy area like immigration be dominated by one party? I mean, there's a lot of issues of fundamental fairness ultimately, and where's the fundamental fairness in millions of people who want to come to the United States and do it the right way, watching people who do it the wrong way be rewarded?
Exactly. Bob Dane, thank you so much. Okay. It's been a real pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for wrapping up my show here
today.
It's
an honor to have you here.
Well, thank you very much. You have a good one, and you did a great job, and so did Kathy, by the way.
She's terrific.
She is terrific. You're very lucky. Hey, I am Ann Ella. Let's hear that quick word, and we'll be right back.
Layaway. We've done it for over 30 years here at Sharp Facets Gallery. So whether it's Christmas, a birthday, an anniversary, or just because, we know layaway every day. Come see us today at Sharp Facets Gallery. Need more info? Call us 229-6613. That's 229-6613.
Hey, boy, it has been an unbelievable afternoon. Let me tell you, folks, I have a lot to think about, and I sure hope you have a lot to think about. And I tell you what, our country needs to stand up. You know, as Chris, our Border Patrol agent, said, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Atlanta is another hub. What are we doing about this? It's coming right across the borders. And whether it's coming across in Arizona or coming across in Texas or any other part of the border, it is coming across. I must say, I think I should have pressed Jeff Duncan a little harder about the comment he made that they said the Mexican government said they were trying. I think I should have pressed him a little harder. I'm a little disappointed in myself in not pressing him a little harder. But that's a subject for another day and another time I'll be able to have that conversation. I do want to say that I have thoroughly enjoyed myself. I've been a little scared this afternoon. You know, that I think there used to be a show called Scared Straight out there. I've been scared straight here this afternoon. I don't know about you, but I sure hope that you'll take this information, that you'll go home and hug your kids and keep them close and try to teach them the right things and make sure they don't get in the wrong direction. And what one of the things that I do agree with that Rusty says is our kids are invincible. They just believe that nothing bad will happen to them, and they know it all, and if you dummy it down and make it simple, they just believe that you really don't know the world. And I tell you what, I think as adults, as parents, as grandparents, sometimes we don't know the world anymore, that they are just adjusting and swimming in and going forth. So try to get a hold of your kids. Try to make sure that they are strong and that they realize that the decisions that they make are not just the decisions about their lives, and if they ever thought that they could die, maybe they would make a different decision, but they're also the decisions that will affect your family. So we've all seen it, drug addicted, we've seen deaths, we've seen horrible things happen to families, but I didn't really realize that the cartels were making that much inroads into our country, and now I am scared. We've got to do something about immigration. I hope that these last 2 days have been something, maybe not my usual light and breezy, easy conversation, but something that you really will think about. And we, of course, will be posting all these interviews on WCRS1450AM.net. And, of course, we'll have links from Facebook back to the interview. Share those with your family. Share those with friends. We have to do something about the immigration. It doesn't matter what color your skin. It's not about that. It is about the fact of having people that understand what our country was built on and what our country, the future of our country, will be. It's in our hands right now. We cannot wash our hands of it. Please, please, please. When you hear the stories I've heard, and what you heard today and yesterday are only portions. I heard a lot more, and my lips are sealed. I'm just going to tell you, my lips are sealed from some of this stuff. It's mind-boggling. Hey, I'm coming back. I'll be back in Greenwood tomorrow. Emerald has done an absolutely fantastic job for me. I hope you've enjoyed all the social media. We did go to the museum this afternoon. We saw a lot of great stuff from the museum. I'm going to upload and post a lot of pictures, probably do a show about it, maybe back there in Greenwood talk about some of the things, because it was truly fantastic. And since the last time I've been there, it's changed, because you know what? It's the news. If you are coming to Washington, D.C., it may not be one of the museums that you think about, but it is very relevant, and let me tell you, your kids will absolutely love it, because it's interactive and something you would really enjoy. I'm going to tell you the truth. I'm done. I'm finished. I'm tired. I'm coming home tomorrow. I've got to celebrate Emerald's birthday tonight. We've got a lot of plans, a lot of things to do. I'll be telling you about it tomorrow afternoon on the air, so make sure you tune in. Tomorrow is actually Emerald's birthday, okay? And I'm going to go ahead and do it. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Emerald. Happy birthday to you and many more.
Thank you, Anne.
Yeah, it's been great. All right, that's going to do it for us. This is WCRS signing off from Washington, D.C., hoping we get to the airport early enough that we're on that plane and home by lunchtime tomorrow. Bye-bye, everybody.